Take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future, and here the results are always positive. Tonight we are streaming to you on six different platforms. We're streaming to you live on Revolution Radio through the America Free Radio Studios, somewhere east of the Appalachian Mountains, and we are also streaming on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Twitch, and on DLive. And DLive is a blockchain format, and highly encourage you to follow the link right down here in the description to DLive.tv/Brooks Agnew and follow me. We're trying to get to 200 followers. Once we do, we can show archives on DLive. It'd be very cool. Right now, we can do that on Twitch, but we cannot do it on DLive until we get to 200 followers. So if you'll help us out there, it would be muy mas appreciated. All right, let's get started. We got a lot to cover tonight. No, I'm not going to cover a whole lot of election stuff. There'll be plenty of time for that on the Sunday night program. And we are also watching the chat on all formats. So, Charlene, good to have you there. Seventh Orbit, good to see you there from DLive. So glad you're out there listening. We're only live on DLive now, but we're going to get we're going to get there. And Thomas is out there in La Jolla. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We'll be watching all of you on all formats. Let's start out talking about lunar ice drilling. Kind of exciting. It's something that has been thought of for a while, but has recently made it in the news. NASA selected Houston-based company called Intuitive Machine. Now, Intuitive Machine is not the name that you would expect for a company that would do lunar exploration. It would be more the name of somebody in the gaming business or something, Intuitive Machine. But they're going to land an ice mining drill on the moon's south pole, which I guess would be in Schrodinger's basin, and they're going to do it by December of 2022. Yeah, it's almost December 2020, so this is like really fast. The space agency agreed to pay Intuitive Machines $47 million to land Polar Resources ice mining experiment called Prime 1 on the moon in the first ever mining mission to drill below the lunar surface. And what are they searching for? Well, yes, water ice. But I guarantee you they're going to find more than that. A mass spectrometer will be used to determine how much of the ice changes from solid to vapor on the lunar surface vacuum. As you know what freeze drying is, right? Well, ice goes directly, it doesn't melt, it goes directly to gas phase, which is called sublimation. But the thing is, on the south pole of the moon, what you have are craters which actually never see direct sunlight. The sunlight goes across, oblique across the surface, and the high mountains which surround the craters keep the crater in the shade. And so in the shade, it sits there around, 20 to 25 degrees Kelvin, which is plenty cold to freeze anything we know of, including helium-3, which I think is going to be the real treasure up there in one of those craters, especially the Shackelford crater, which is the big one. So the interesting thing is going to be to land in that South Pole region and be able to set up and drill. Now, I don't know if you know how a mass spec works. A mass spectrophotometer or mass spectrometer works off of molecular weight. Typically what they have is a quadrupole filter. Let's see if I can build one really fast here. I think I can. Hang on a second. Yes. Show you what a quadrupole filter is. All right. So a quadrupole filter looks a little bit like this. Okay, it has these four poles, like what you see here. And what it'll be is like positive, negative, DC. And then what they'll do is, as you notice, there's a hole down the middle of this. What they'll do is they'll pull the molecules in to the center of this, and they will vary the voltage on each of these to line up with a specific molecular weight. So for water, it would be 18 grams per mole, right? So they would vary the voltage to align with that particular molecular weight. And then what they would have is a detector plate here in the back. So if the molecule makes it all the way down and doesn't ground out against these poles and smacks that plate, they know that that is 18 molecular weight. Now, do they know it's water? Well, no. They can make a guess. It's oxygen and two hydrogens, right? Are there other things that weigh 18 molecular weight? Yeah, but they're not going to be the exact voltage of water. So that's how a mass spectrometer works. It just works off of molecular weight. Now, typically we match this with a GC, a gas chromatograph. And this will have like another kind of detector on, usually a flame ionization detector, fed with hydrogen gas, a flame sitting there. And when the molecule hits that flame, it volatilizes. And when it volatilizes, it gives off a spectrum of light, which is unique to the bonds between those different atoms. Those atoms have specific molecular weight, and so the bonds are a specific length, hence a specific guitar string, a specific frequency, and we'll be able to tell exactly what that is, especially if we run an unknown compound through it first, and we can be sure under those conditions that that's exactly what we're looking at. So that's basically the chemistry. Pretty simple instrumentation. We use them all the time. They're very reliable under a lot of different conditions. And I think it's important because we want to determine whether it's ice or whether it's helium-3 or some other thing, deuterium or tritium or something like that. So the data is going to assist NASA's rover, the Volatiles Investigating Polar Exploration Rover, called Viper, searching for water ice on the moon's pole to determine an area that will support a human presence in 2024. Hello, it's 2020. That's 4 years. That means this stuff has been in the development for a while. You don't just start up a NASA program, do all the testing and failure modes, effects analysis and everything, and put something in space and all the way to the moon in 4 years. It just doesn't happen. All this stuff's been developed for a while. I will quote the CLPS program vendor here. Let's see. We continue to rapidly select vendors from our pool of commercial lunar payload services program vendors to land payloads on the lunar surface, which exemplifies our work to integrate, and that's a key word, integrate, the ingenuity of commercial industry into our efforts on the moon. And that's NASA's Associate Administrator for Science, Thomas Zurbuchen. Intuitive Machines is going to fly this 88-pound Prime 1 to the moon no later than December of 2022 on its Nova C lander as part of the CLPS. The company is one of several space firms selected by NASA to conduct robotic missions on the moon. Very neat stuff. I'm really excited about this. Let's see. I'll put some slides up there I put together of this so you can see these different pieces of machinery. Intuitive Machines CEO Steve Altemus said in a statement that laying the foundation to return humans to the moon is an incredible honor, an even greater challenge. And at Intuitive Machines, we're hungry for the pursuit of these audacious missions that will redefine what a small business is capable of, close quote. I love it. I love it because NASA, you know, typically is just a government agency and they just shuffle money around and basically move money from one budget to another. And before long, they've consumed all the money and nothing really got accomplished. Hey, we need more money. And JPL, which is basically a really expensive and capable private contractor that has preferential treatment when it comes to, you know, placement of military programs in space. But these small companies, the ones like Intuitive Machines and others that are really coming up with neat technologies that they've developed for a while, and some of this technology has been used in other programs, and it's all being pulled together by private industry, entrepreneurs, small companies. $47 million is a decent size space program, but it is all going to a single company with a very few employees. Prime 1 is going to drill down 3 feet below the lunar surface to search for buried water ice, according to NASA. And it's not just water they're after, apparently. Natural resources are abundant on the moon. Why? Well, that's a good question. Somebody brought this up inadvertently at the Cracker Barrel the other morning where they were complaining about, yeah, we have a space program, but we can't get decent health insurance. Well, you know, one plays off of the other. We get all kinds of neat technologies that come from exploring the moon, not the least of which is, you know, cell phones and medical technologies and all kinds of robotics and circuitry and software and all these kinds of things that spin off from those industries. But the moon has been exposed to solar radiation pretty much uninterrupted for 4 billion years. And there isn't anything on the moon to oxidize those things. In other words, there's no atmosphere to oxidize or to oxygenate those compounds. So they stay in their original depleted state, being bombarded by solar radiation for, you know, millions of centuries. And this is the kind of stuff that we really want to see. That's where helium-3 comes from. We do have helium-3 on the Earth, but not in large quantities. It's mostly formed near volcanoes, And as soon as it hits our atmosphere, it dissipates rather quickly, goes up to high altitude, and through free radical conversion turns into helium-4. And that's what we fill our party balloons with, but it's not really of much use to us as far as energy. But helium-3 is very interesting to us as far as energy because it is light, a proton. And the nice thing about this is when we fuse light a proton, light a neutron, when we fuse helium-3 together, what we end up with is helium-4, yes, but we end up with two free protons. And those protons are controllable, whereas neutrons are radioactive and not controllable. And then we have to kind of absorb them with stuff like lead. And then that becomes nuclear waste later on that we have to deal with. Not so with helium-3 turning into helium-4. Not only that, when it fuses together, it makes a tremendous amount of energy. And the energy could be used to make steam. Steam could be used to turn turbines. Turbines can be used to make electricity. So basically what you have is the ability to make electricity without radiation in a couple different ways, not just the spinning of the turbine, but also the gathering of the protons themselves. So it's very, very efficient and very, very plentiful. So the amount of helium-3 that's on the moon just in the Shackelford crater is enough to power all the nuclear power plants on the Earth for centuries. And no pollution. No pollution. And you don't have to dig up anything. Don't have to fight wars over it. And you can't make weapons out of it. Well, I suppose you could, but my goodness, look at the activation energy it would take to get one going. One thing you do get out of it, though, I think, is fusion rocketry. And fusion rocketry, wow. Excuse me while I cough this dish rag up. Fusion rocketry opens up the entire solar system for us. So instead of taking 7 months to get to Mars, now we can do it in less than 70 days. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine recently said the space agency is set to purchase rare earth materials mined from the moon by private companies. Not too long ago, NASA discovered that underneath the lunar surface, there is an abundance of natural resources. Took a while to find it. And the drilling and digging equipment is currently being designed, and it's very, very cool stuff. The sequence of events is pretty much laid out to the year 2025, which is not very far away. If all goes according to plan, the newly announced Lunar Mission 1 will drill at least 65 feet and perhaps as much as 330 feet underground at the moon's south pole in 2024, collecting samples that could shed light on the formation of the Earth and the moon, as well as the feasibility of a manned lunar outpost in the area, project organizers said. And as I say in my book, Asteroid Mining, the Future of Energy, what we would really like to see is the development of underground facilities on the moon. So we're talking about lunar volcanic vents, which can go back into the moon 15 kilometers or so. And if you, what do you mean, aren't there aliens on the moon? Ray Jacobs says, aren't there aliens on the moon? Well, if they are, or there are, they're going to have to deal with us, right? Blue Otter says, the same as Thomas in La Jolla, as coast to coast, I suppose he's saying. He says, if so, you're my favorite caller. If not, greetings. Hitchhiker, greetings. Beautiful peeps. Good to see you out there, Hitchhiker. Nice to have everybody in the chat room. Listen, if you're listening on YouTube, there is something you can do. You can slide down to the bottom and you'll see that little square with a dollar sign in it. We call that Top Chat. That's how we YouTubers collect money, because we don't get monetized off ads anymore. YouTube took all that away from us. If you're at all conservative, you don't get any of that. But the only way to get money out of YouTube is Top Chat. In DLive, it's pretty cool because it's in different form. It's in cryptocurrency known as lemons, or you'll see the different currencies that are there. They start in the pennies and go up to dollars. And in Twitch, you can subscribe, and subscribing, I think a minimum, I think it's $3.99 a month. Twitch gets a little bit of it. We get a little bit of it, and it helps keep the lights on and keep things going. So yes, yes, yes. It's all part of the revenue engine for podcasters. And why are we doing this? We're doing this because YouTube is systematically hunting us down and kicking us off. So unless you toe the party line, which we don't, then they're going to hunt you down and kick you off. It's only a matter of time before America Free Radio is gone off of YouTube, I think. We're conservative enough, and we believe in truth, justice, and the American way, which is not what Google is about at all. If you don't believe me, you needed to watch some of the hearings today. Hello, Charlene. Good to see you out there. And Ray, good to see you out there. Everybody seems to know one another. Mark is out there, Mark Hovsepian. Why go to the moon craters for ice when we have so many ice holes here on Earth? Yes, yes, we have farging ice holes here on Earth. We do. Saw a bunch of them on TV today. Yeah, not what we're looking for, but humorous nonetheless. So what we want to do is go deep underground. It'll give us a look at the pristine ancient rock untouched by cosmic radiation or meteorite impacts over the eons. The mission representatives added, Lunar Mission 1 will make a huge contribution to our understanding of the origins of the planet and the moon. That's part of it. We are looking for energy. We're looking for minerals. We don't like digging up our planet and shoveling it into our tanks and burning it. Not when there's 2 days away, a plentiful supply right here in our own solar system. While the unmanned Lunar Mission 1 was just announced yesterday, actually it was announced about a year ago, but we're just now getting excited about it. It has been in the works for the past 7 years. The United Kingdom-based mission aims to pay for its ambitious activities in several different ways, starting with the Kickstarter campaign that launched Tuesday last November. Organizers hope the crowdfunding effort will raise about $950,000, which it did, which would fund initial development operations. People will also be able to purchase digital memory boxes, giving participants the chance to contribute to a time capsule that Lunar Mission 1 plans to bury as part of its work. I don't know how that's going. Market research suggests that 1% of people around the world who can afford a digital memory box will buy one, potentially resulting in revenues of about $4.7 billion. Well, good luck with that. Any surplus money raised will be put into a charitable trust dedicated to funding future space science and exploration activities. Noble. It's noble, I would say. Lunar Missions Limited runs Lunar Mission 1 with the assistance of a number of partner organizations, including the Royal, well, whatever RAL is, Space, RAL Space, which is part of the United Kingdom Space and Technologies Facilities Council, University College London, the Open University in the United Kingdom, and the Institute of Education in London. Lunar Mission 1 is both ambitious and innovative, demonstrating an exciting way of enabling lunar exploration. It's all about funding. The $47 million from NASA is going to definitely help to get that mission up there. We'll see what kind of launch engine they get and how it goes. We have some luck putting robots and rovers on the moon. The Chinese have done it, although their rover's long since dead. The Indians recently tried it. It splatted on the surface of the moon. No luck there. We don't have a rover on the moon anymore, not that's operational. So we'll see what happens. If we get it up there, get it drilled, get the measurements made, then the gold rush is on. Leanne, nice to see you out there. Yes, XO, back to you too. Eric, I want a digital forget-me box, not a memory box. Okay, well, that's easy enough. For a mere $1.7 billion, I will send you a box that you could put nothing in, Eric, and we could fix you right up. And I won't even tell you where we bury it. How about that? Yes, I know. It is easier on Susie. That's why everyone is there. Hello from the West Coast of Canada, praying for your president to get reelected. Yeah, I think it's kind of academic. We may talk a little bit about that later. I've talked to a couple of people here in North Carolina that voted. Everybody in the line, as far as the line went, was there for Trump. I haven't seen any Biden voters in the line at all. I think there's only two Biden signs in our whole subdivision, so I don't even know how many Biden voters there are in North Carolina. It is interesting, though, to watch the effort because, you know, they're kind of setting us up for something extreme, and I hate to see it, but nonetheless, it seems to be going that way, and I don't want to see it go that way, but we'll see what happens. We'll cover a little bit more later on. This is a two-hour program, no callers yet. If I get enough top chat, I'm going to add some equipment. It takes a couple of pieces of equipment to be able to take calls here. But once I get that, then we'll be able to take calls during the Revolution Radio program here on Wednesday nights. And we'll do the same as we do on Sunday nights, although don't get very many calls on Sunday nights. So it's a little bit not motivational for me to get off the hip and buy the equipment to be able to do it here. So if you all want it, then show a little initiative and we'll get the equipment in here and we'll be able to take calls. Yes, I agree, Susie. She says, that is awesome, Brooks. He is the world's president. He will fund more space travel. Yeah, and I think it's a lot to do with the Space Force, being able to provide an independent force that will keep pirates from stealing what you build, keep hackers from hacking into your software and smashing your stuff into one another up there in space, and also to be able to provide some kind of, you know, continuity so that private investors like Elon Musk and Blue Origin and others who are putting equipment up into not only low Earth orbit but geostationary orbit, and then we're going to keep going on out till we get into the gravity wells, which are the Lagrange points. There are five of them around the Earth, but certainly three of them are very practical for us. And we could build space stations out there, which would give us the ability to refuel in space, to observe things in deep space without light pollution. And also, they would have microgravity, so you wouldn't be completely without gravity. Depending on what size asteroid we pull into the gravity well and set there, it would be pretty stable. But it would also protect the Earth from near-Earth objects coming in, because we'd be able to put defensive systems on such a space station that could take care of any pesky comets or meteorites or asteroids that look like they're going to collide with Earth, which we can't do right now. We just can't do. And we can't refuel in space. Look how aviation changed on our planet when we could refuel airplanes in flight. I mean, it changed everything, right? You could take fighters on long distance and run a fueler up there and, you know, a C-47 or something up there. And you could then refuel airplanes in flight and stay up there for a long time. Same thing with B-52s and others. And It changed air flight, and it will change space flight. And right now, we can't refuel satellites, which would be kind of nice to do. There's a lot of dead satellites up there that have run out of retro fuel. We just let their orbits decay, and slowly they fall back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere. We go refuel the space station from time to time so we can reposition it around. But that's because we can dock with it. We can do stuff, but we don't have companies set up to be able to go up into low Earth orbit and fix satellites and refuel them and collect dead satellites and bring them back to Earth. We just don't have a system for being able to do that yet, but we will. And it's the Space Force that's made all that possible, and it's President Trump that has made the Space Force possible. Really has become president of the world, not in the sense that he's ruling the world, but that he's serving the world. And good to see you out there, everyone. Charlene is out there. She says, hi, Boo. Boo says, hi, Charlene. let's see, some talk about Cheyenne Mountain. I've been to Cheyenne Mountain and have seen your American kids running the satellites. They're amazing. Yeah. Cheyenne Mountain is where NORAD is. And just about everything that flies over North America all the way out to deep space is monitored or run from Cheyenne Mountain. And it's gone through a couple of upgrades. There are other facilities too. There's Site R, which is in Pennsylvania, which was built in 1946 and has been upgraded a couple of times. There's a couple of other locations that are underground. Some of them are on mountains, and they do control as well. Yes, and they're mostly young people because, A, they're really smart. B, they don't require a lot of money. And C, some of the technology is so new that us old dogs can't learn it. And so it takes young people to be able to keep up with it. All right, let's talk about extreme planet. As Earth telescopes scan the stars for planets that may support life, they also find plenty of things that have astronomers kind of scratching their heads. It's very interesting stuff. Let's see if I can switch over to my Jupiter flyby. This is a good one. I like it. Researchers say a planet they call a hot Neptune. It falls right into the head-scratching category. Not only does this scalding hot world travel around its sun in less than a day, how would you like to have a year last a day? It has an atmosphere that isn't supposed to exist. University of Kansas astronomer Ian Crossfield says new data from NASA's TESS, called TESS, and Spitzer Space Telescopes is providing the first look at an exoplanet's atmosphere the satellites captured. It's a planet called LTT-9779b, which sits about 260 light years from Earth, and it's so close to its home star, it doesn't have ground for a probe to land on. This planet doesn't have a solid surface, and it's much hotter than our Mercury in our solar system. It would only not only would lead melt in the atmosphere of this planet, but so would platinum, chromium, and even stainless steel. A year on this planet is less than 24 hours. That's how quickly it's whipping around its star. It's a pretty extreme system. Pretty interesting stuff. I'm fascinated by finding stuff like this. It's like Discovery Channel on steroids. All right, last week we kind of touched on the physics of consciousness. And as you know, once a month I teach a two-day class, one Saturday one week, one Saturday the next week. In November, the first class is on November 7th. The second class is on November 14th. It's about 2.5 hours the first day and about 2 hours the second day. So you get 4.5 hours of class time, plus you get a book, plus you get the audio version of that book, and plus you get the ability to interact live during the class. And it sets you up for one-on-one if you want to go beyond that and build a business or take your business to the next level. And in this class, we talk about the physics of the soul. It's a presentation that I was making live on stage in front of people. And as you know, Operation Corona Scare put the kibosh on most of that stuff for 2020. So rather than not do it at all this year, I decided to make it as a webinar, and it's been okay. It's been okay. I'm willing to sit here on a Saturday and spend a couple of hours with you, 2-3 hours with you, which you get the same presentation that I would make on a stage, but you get it almost one-on-one, small class setting, and you get to ask questions. You actually learn more and get to spend more time with me than you would at a conference, because at a conference there'll be anywhere from 20 to 50 speakers, and you'd be running all over the place trying to catch this speaker and that speaker, and you don't get to see everybody you want because Oftentimes, we speak at the same times in different rooms. So this way, you get to see the whole thing. And I give you access to a recording of it. So you can go back anytime and go back over the things that you might have missed, which you don't get a chance to do in a conference. So it's worked out okay. For me, I've been able to at least meet with some students and some people that just want to hear the lecture. And it also keeps me sharp and helps me to build my lesson plan. And one of the things that we cover is the physics of the soul. So when I say the physics of the soul, I don't just mean word salad. I mean, we're looking for insights into why we need electromagnetic fields to encode integrated conscious information. We physicists are a little bit like sticks in the mud, I guess, in the sense that we really hold to the idea that if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, that it didn't make a sound. Why? Because there was nobody there to measure it. It is important. In fact, it's vital to the thought process. Yes, Brian says bacteria probably thrives there. It could. You know, there are extremophores that exist in extreme conditions. Although I think to melt stainless steel, I think you got to get to about 3,600 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a little warm, even for bacteria. I don't know if anything organic would be able to survive at that temperature, but could be wrong. Could be bacteria that's not organic, you know, iron-based or silicon-based bacterium instead of carbon-based. Interesting thoughts, Brian. What would they look like? Kind of crazy. They'd be freezing to death here, that's for sure, especially today. So when we talk about the physics of the soul, we are really talking about how do we go about measuring consciousness. Hey, we just recently, excuse me, let's take a sip of my ice cold orange juice here. You got to give us a break here because we just recently came to terms with the idea that consciousness is a force in the universe. We used to think there were just four forces, the strong and weak molecular forces, and then gravity and electromagnetism. Give us credit. We recently added consciousness to those forces. So now we agree there are five. And many of us are at least coming around to the idea that consciousness may be the prime force, that is to say, the downward causative force of the universe, consciousness first, and then all of the forces after that. Still, we want to be able to measure it. We want to be able to quantify it. How fast does it go? Where is it located? What's its charge? Is there a difference between one consciousness and another? Matter is, you know, particulate, whereas electromagnetic energy, such as, you know, light or X-rays, they're mostly composed of waves, right? They're in the wave form. And it's only when they collapse, like when we try to identify how fast it's going or try to measure its spin or its location, that it collapses to particle. So it has a kind of a wave-particle duality. It has weight and it has, you know, behavior like a particle, but it has spectrum. It has frequency of a wave. It propagates like a wave. It moves like a wave. It sounds like a wave. Nevertheless, the foundational experiments of quantum mechanics demonstrated that particles have these wave-like particles and waves have associated particle properties. We wrestle with it all the time. It's why we work with at least our desires to come up with a theory for everything. One theory. We don't have like gravitation over here and then all the other forces over there, because gravity is what we see at least demonstrated in the behavior of planets and their motion. And everything else is what we see demonstrated in the behavior of quantum behavior, quantum particles, quantum waves, electromagnetic charges, things like that. I don't trust that Blink 182 guy, but he said gravity is consciousness, which I thought interesting. Tom DeLonge, that's the guy. It's easy to say, you know, here's the thing, Eric, and there's a lot of people that do this, and gosh, I have respect for them, love for some of them. They get wrapped up in this word salad. They use words like alchemy, or they use words like quantum, yeah, I get it. It's sort of like an English major being irritated at people misusing words in sentences. You understand what I'm saying? It's not that we get, frustrated with it, or we try to educate people, but word salad has a tendency to make people's eyes glaze over, and people like Blink 182 say that gravity is consciousness. Well, no, it isn't, okay? Gravity is not consciousness, and consciousness is not gravity. Now, that's not to say that a planet doesn't have consciousness. A rock or a fish or a bird or a leaf or a snake, all of that has consciousness. Humans are the only beings, as far as we know, that can perceive time. We're the only ones that can perceive time. No other animal on the face of the earth exhibits any kind of behavior that leads us to believe that it has an understanding of time. Schedules, yes, like phases of the moon or positions of the sun or seasons of the year, or, hey, I got to be on this beach on this certain day to lay my eggs. Yes, that kind of time is obvious. We see that in nature all the time, from butterflies to swallows to sea turtles. But as far as the difference between one day and another, wow, Cherokee Drifter just gave one hell of a donation on Top Chat. Said, you got me, Brooks. Either your show, enjoy your show, and it's great to get real news. Go Trump, our country and Constitution is on the line. Yes, I agree. Thank you so much for the generous donation. It's going to make a big difference. We may add those phone lines yet. That was, wow, pretty strong. I appreciate it very much. The idea is that I don't want to get lost in a word salad here. The idea is what we want to talk about is quantifying consciousness. Now, that's not saying that one human is, any stronger than another, although there's something to be said that, we do get very strong consciousnesses that come into our existence. It's not very often that you get a Jesus or a Buddha or Donald Trump, for that matter. They come into life early. You could tell at a young age that they're going to have an effect on the universe, a big one. Bill Clinton's and others like that. Some is for good and some is for ill. Hitler or Patton or, different personalities, different forces of will have different effects on the universe. But that's not to say that there's any difference in value between one person and another, but there is a difference in frequency. There is a difference in amplitude. Amplitude is the height of a wave, and the frequency is the number of waves in a fixed length. So when we talk about frequency, we're talking about so many waves in a meter or so many waves in a millimeter compared to someone else. And that can change. We could change our own frequency up or down. That is to say, higher frequency or lower frequency, depending on our level of love or hatred. Hatred, I think, has a very low frequency, but a very high amplitude. Oh, it's loud. It's loud, but it's dark. It does not have much light to it. Love can be very sweet and very tender and very high frequency, but not very powerful in the sense that it's a very soft kind of sound. When we think about things like the Holy Ghost, for instance, the Holy Ghost is a still small voice. It's not a shout. It's not a slap in the face. It's something you have to listen for. It's something you have to tune yourself into. Yeah, it's the ultimate high frequency, absolutely high frequency, but it isn't really loud. It's low amplitude, high frequency. So when we talk about these wave-like properties of consciousness, I think what we're talking about here is consciousness is not matter in our third dimension. It has an effect in our third dimension. It may even be measurable in our third dimension, but it can't be quantified in the sense that, you know, this soul weighs so much or is going so fast or has this molecular weight. It isn't like that, but it is expressed in our dimension in terms of frequency, in terms of wave-like properties. Physically unified, integrated information could then potentially be encoded in matter, like water or like crystals, in especially if their associated matter waves overlap. Now, I don't know if you know how a transformer works. I'm going to explain this in as small amount of time as I can. If you have one coil of wire, and then right next to it, even maybe wrapped up with it, you have another coil of wire. They're not touching one another, but they're close to one another. And you put a frequency on one coil of wire. Inductively, that frequency will induce a current flow in the other coil of wire, okay? So they're not electrically connected. They're electromagnetically connected. And that's what happens with human consciousness. When you put a human being in a social setting, and the closer the proximity, the better, like an elevator or an embrace or a dance or making love or something like that. When you put two souls in very close proximity to one another, then the frequency of one soul can induce a current flow or electromagnetic information in the other soul. And the more you can amplify that, and we're doing that right now electronically through this great neural network of six different networks at one time, six different platforms at one time, I'm trying to get my frequencies and my thoughts and my ability to put those thoughts into words as close as I can to you so it will couple to you and induce a similar feeling in you, a similar amount of information in you. All word salad aside, the wave-like properties of matter particles are, however, limited by their de Broglie wavelength, which is inversely proportional to their momentum. You know, it's the product when you multiply mass times velocity. Okay, you get force, you get energy, right? Mass times velocity. Something's heavy and it's moving very fast, like a semi going 80 miles an hour has a lot more energy behind it than, say, a Corvette traveling 80 miles an hour. Mass times velocity. That's how you get the energy. So an electron with rest mass energy of, say, I don't know, half a mega electron volt, and a kinetic energy of, say, one electron volt, which would be like a hydrogen proton, one electron volt, will have an associated de Broglie wavelength of 1.23 nanometers. That's the length it takes to go a complete wave, 1.3 nanometers, which is 1.3 billionths of a meter. This is larger than the typical size of atoms by a bunch. So electrons are delocalized in atomic orbitals of molecules such as benzene, whose three pi electrons are delocalized across all six carbon atoms in the molecule. I don't have one here with me, but picture a six-sided, you know, hexagon, and each one of those points is a carbon atom, which links together to make the benzene ring. If I turn the ring sideways like this, of course, you'd be looking at it flatways, each carbon atom will have like a balloon of electrons on top of it. Those are called pi electrons. Now, depending on what temperature the benzene ring is, those pi electrons are in different formations. if I were to take something like, you know, I'm going to use this as an example. It's not actually ceramic. But if I were to take a ceramic disc like so, okay, and I were to say, okay, all these electrons are aligned in this ceramic. That's what makes it ceramic. And then I'm going to take it and chill it down to, say, I don't know, minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which is somewhere around liquid nitrogen. What's going to happen is these atoms are going to get closer and closer and closer to one another. But the other thing that's going to happen is the pi electrons are going to relax, and they're all going to stand up. So when they stand up, now what we've got is a charge on top of this thing. And because we have a charge on top of this thing, this ordinarily not magnetic piece of ceramic is now magnetic. That's what we call a superconducting magnet. Not magnetic, and now it's magnetic because it's cold, because the electrons are all on one side, and now we have a charge which attracts metal, like so. Okay, so now you know how that works. The electronic information encoded in the matter of electrons is thereby physically unified within molecules. However, the proton is about 1,800 times more massive than an electron. Electrons are very tiny, okay? Very, very tiny. So the de Broglie wavelength, and thereby its wave-like properties when traveling at the same speed as the electron, is 1,800 times smaller, right? All the math has to work out here. The matter of protons is thereby localized entirely within the nucleus of each atom because it can't behave as a wave. The electron, however, can. To examine the three proton bits, it would be necessary to interrogate all three atoms within the molecule because each bit is locked within the de Broglie wavelength of each particle. They're discrete, they're localized, and they cannot be mistaken for anything else, unlike humans. Humans can... Oh, you got to take off, Charlene? All right, we'll see you. Okay, sorry, just reading the chat and interacting with them. So, really, no two humans are alike. Does that mean we can't align with one another? Of course we can. And if we do, we can constructively interfere with one another and we can create a tremendous amount of energy. That's kind of what we see happening right now with I guess you call it national politics, but it's really global politics. What we understand is that with constructive interference, it's sort of like we have an arena, let's say a Colosseum, and normally we'd be playing football on the grass of the Colosseum, but today what we're going to do is have 200 guitar players, 200 guitar players, and they're all going to play the same song, same rhythm, same chords. Now, ordinarily, you could sit in the stands, and if there was one person standing at the 50-yard line playing an acoustic guitar, you wouldn't hear diddly squat, would you? Nope, because the wavelength is the same, but the amplitude is so low that without an amplifier, it's never going to reach the stands. But if we put 200 guitar players, no amplifiers, just the guitar players, all playing the same chords, what happens is the sound adds to one another. You actually get more than 200 guitars worth of constructive interference because you have resonance happening all over the place. Chances are you would be able to hear those guitars standing in or sitting in the stands because of the constructive interference. Well, that's what it's like when we all get on the same wavelength. When we're all on the, quote, same page together, what happens is we constructively interfere with one another. That is to say, we add our energy one to another, and we become a greater, brighter, more powerful, unstoppable sound. Yes, it's almost the same as one guy with a big amplifier, but we're not all the same. We don't go through life as a big amplified being. We're just us. Now, the dark side understands this, And so what they do is they, oh, I see. Susie's internet has gone down. You know, that's happening a lot. I see that. I'm hardwired to the modem. The rest of the computers in this complex are all hooked up wirelessly, and they come and go. I mean, the modem is on and off, and not really sure why that's happening. It may not just be you, Susie, but the point I'm trying to make here is the dark side exposes us to their ideas, and they do it over and over and over again. And what they do is they borrow our attention. Let's call it glory for to make the argument simple. And what they do is they get us to think about their idea. And once we think about their idea, we start adding energy, be it good or bad, to their idea. And so they get to manifest their idea of the future because they get all of us to think about what they want us to think about. And they do that by controlling the airwaves. They put their ideas and their thoughts out on radio and TV and even the internet and all the social media, and we hear it. So what we try to do at this station at America Free Radio is we try to put out the bright energy, the high frequency, and try to do the same thing. We try to reach as many people as we can so we can get you all to think about these higher things, and thus we create a destructive interference with that dark energy and a constructive interference with the light energy. And that's what we're trying to do. That's why the physics of the soul is so important. Okay, under normal circumstances, the information encoded within matter particles is integrated only within the atoms, but that is not the case with consciousness. With consciousness, we have electromagnetic energy which goes above and beyond the neurotransmitters. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Nicholas Commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
What?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they a government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
All right. Thanks so much for being part of America Free Radio tonight. So glad to be here on the Revolution Radio Network. And we're coming to you through several different platforms, YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and Twitch and also DLive. And we are trying to get to 200 followers on DLive.tv. So please head on over there if you get a chance. DLive.tv/Brooks Agnew. It's free to follow us. And once you do, once we get to 200, we'll be able to offer archives on that platform. And maybe then we can greatly affect the universe. So we were talking about the physics of the soul. We were talking about consciousness and electromagnetic force. And I wanted to get a little bit, finish this off for you because I don't want to leave you hanging. There's a thing called the semi field, the CEMI field. And it goes back to Einstein. He came up with special relativity through a thought experiment of what the universe would look like from the frame of a photon. Understanding awareness requires a similar shift to the frame of the electromagnetic field of the brain. I was having a discussion with Dr. Ed Close, who wrote a book called Transcendental Physics, which was an interesting book, and it was entertaining. And there was a few things that he said in the book that got me really thinking, and so I wanted to talk to him about it. And one of the thoughts was that there is no path for the photon from, say, the star Arcturus to here, because I had remarked to him that, you know, I like to go out at night and look up at the stars. And when I look at Arcturus, I say, wow, how amazing it is that those photons leave that star, you know, 8-something light years away, and the photons miss, you know, gas particles and rocks and, you know, electromagnetic fields between there and here, and they strike the rods and cones in my eye, and then I can see Arcturus. And he said, well, yeah, that's your perspective, but from the photon's perspective, there's no path from Arcturus to here. It's instantaneous. And it reminded me of Einstein's thought experiment, that here we are on this ship that is sitting on the surface of a photon, and the photon is going through space at the speed of light. This is where Einstein came up with his special relativity, thinking that the speed of light is the fastest thing in the universe, so everything else is relative to it. And it helped us understand a lot of things and theories, predictions that he made based upon that theory turned out to be accurate to as tightly as we could measure them. So I would like to do that just a little bit here tonight, except not in space, on a photon traveling from one star to Earth around a main sequence sun on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, but to think about a photon in the brain. Because we're talking about the electromagnetic field of the brain. So we can, for example, consider what it would be like to be one photon in the cloud of photons that travel from emitting to receiving electrons in the neuronal membranes of the brain. So we're having a thought, or we're creating a relationship, some transitory relationship that only humans can do. We can take, you know, the taste of peanut butter and organic chemistry, and we can combine them to create some intractable memory so that we can pass an exam, or we can take music from a guitar or piano or a cello, and we can relate it to architecture or art or painting or the motion of water, or there's transitory relationships that we can form only in our minds. But so between these points, these photons carry, you know, about 10 bits of information encoded in the photon's energy. You have spin, you have direction, you have all these little bits that go with the information of that photon. However, between the emission of it and the absorption of it, the photons are more properly considered as delocalized waves, okay? They're not photonic particles. They're not like marbles bouncing around on the inside of our heads. They obey Maxwell's laws. Clerk Maxwell was a great mathematician. He was a fantastic algebraic mathematician, and he was capable of capturing in the elegance of mathematics the structures of black holes and the motion of photons. And we use those laws today, and they're reliable and they're repeatable for us. So this semi-field is then the superposition of not just one, but trillions of photon waves whose information is encoded in their ensuing pattern of constructive and destructive interference, as I was telling you about. So where a wave meets a wave, it adds to one another and it creates a resonance. Where a wave meets a valley, they cancel each other out, destroying one another. And hopefully we're able to consciously manipulate that so we don't sit here at DC all the time with no thought at all, mindless and will-less, but that we have great and profound thoughts and great and profound intentions toward one another, which are constructive and life-giving. We don't see a lot of that. In fact, I made an interesting observation the other day. Whether we're talking about rioters in London or Seattle or Oklahoma or in Minnesota, the interesting thing that I noticed about these, and I'm sure you have too, is the rage, okay? They have the mask on, yes, so you can't really almost tell what they're saying, especially if the sound turned off. But the eyes are bulging and the hands are motioning. And when you turn the sound on, the interesting thing is it doesn't matter what language it is, you hear the same energy. You hear the same energy. It's almost as though these rioters, these BLM people, these Antifa people, they're possessed. They're possessed with a demon. And that demon energy that we see, that rage that we see, is what strikes fear in us. And it strikes fear in me because I realize that those humans that we're seeing on camera, they have abdicated their own will. They've given up their own will over to a demon, and they're now possessed by this rage demon. Whether they've been paid to be there or not paid to be there is irrelevant. What is relevant is that they have all assumed the same frequency, the same dark frequency. Okay? Be that as it may, within the brain, the light cones of all the trillions of emitted photons will almost entirely overlap. They'll interfere with one another in this overlapping. They'll either build on one another or destroy one another. any charged particle in the brain, or even outside the brain, can potentially be the receiver of any of the trillions of emitted 10-bit packages of information available in the entire field. Get it? So, and it's not just your brain talking to itself. There's other frequencies that you're being exposed to. Music and even energies that are in the galaxy. The Spirit of God, let's call it, being in tune with the Spirit of God or with the Holy Ghost. But also one another. We're in tune with or out of tune with, but we're affected by the cone of particles in the brains and outside the brains of any two or more than one, let's just say, more than one soul in the same proximity with one another. So each point in the field represents the integrations of trillions of bits of physically encoded information. You encoded it. Other people encoded it. God encoded it. Lucifer encoded it. Okay, all of that you can add energy to or take energy away from. Now, it's been proposed that nearly all the quanta, you know, the sound of C minor, let's say, the meaning of the number seven, the image of a triangle or a tetrahedron, all of these things, you know, the concept of an electric car, or a gas-powered engine, or an airplane, the feeling of anger, they're all similarly complex, okay? They're not simple thoughts or simple ideas. These conscious states that integrate parallel information streams to form this model that is both complex and it's physically unified within this semi-field. That is the qualia associated with hearing the musical note middle C. It is what elicits a feeling in you. One of the reasons, one of the big reasons why we go to church every Sunday is not so much to hear the preacher. I doubt you could ever remember any of the sermons that you heard. It's not. It's the music. It's the music. It's the keys and the notes and the minors and the harmonies of the music and the singing. That's what cleans you. That's what bathes you. That's what fixes whatever went wrong with you during the week. And when you leave church at the end of the day, you feel like you're able to face another Monday because you are sort of reset. You kind of hit Control-Alt-Delete while you're exposed to that electromagnetic frequency of the music, even if you don't have a piano in your church, if it's just human voices. Okay, the electromagnetic field perturbation, that is to say, frequencies running into one another. They perturb one another. That's what a perturbation means. It correlates with the sensory input of the music. And it's what it feels like from the inside that makes you new. Okay, it's what makes you feel melancholy when you hear certain music. It's what makes you excited and and Hitchhiker says, yeah, I think heavy metals, vaccines, frequencies all make peeps susceptible to programming. And they could. The chemicals that you ingest, whether they're drugs or alcohol or whether they're medicines or foreign substances that could be put in there by nefarious players out there, they all can make you susceptible to different frequencies. What we have to be is conscious enough that we're conscious that we could choose to be influenced by it or not. Susie says, I think I see what Brooks is trying to tell us. You are already a part of God. Your brain and soul is a direct call or a part of God. Our souls touch each other. Yes. In fact, you know, this has been on people's minds a lot, Susie, and it has been for a long time. When Jesus came onto the scene, he was 30 years old, arrived in Jordan, and the first thing he did was, you know, round up his disciples, right? which they are all strong men, but, you know, from doctors to tax collectors to fishermen, they weren't all, you know, rich or powerful men, but they were who he chose, and he chose them for certain reasons. And they all traveled together and pretty much picked figs and lived off donations, not really planning for the future too much, but just being happy to be in Jesus' presence, because he answered a lot of questions and he made them think about a lot of things. I'm sure he spoke a lot more than what the red letters are in the New Testament of the Bible. But they had the same questions that we have today and that you raise in your statement. And that is, when they had time to themselves, they realized that, hey, we live in a pretty complex world, and we live in a pretty complex government and a complex society that has all kinds of rules and regulations and customs, and we don't really know, you know, what's up. But what we do know is Jesus knows. So let's ask him. Let's ask him, because there's a lot to keep up with, you know, and we might miss something. We might focus on the wrong thing. And so they went to him and they said, Jesus, Master, listen, we have a question. We've been thinking about this for a while, you know, while we were lagging behind you and Mary up here walking and talking. And that is, we really want to know, what is the greatest commandment? You know, because if we could get like that one down, we could work on all the rest. But what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus really didn't hesitate, didn't take a long time to think about this. You have to understand this was originally written in Greek, which is a syllogistic way of writing. That is to say, you state the conclusion and then the premises. So let me say it the way it would normally have been said, because it makes the most sense, and you'll see it instantly when I say it. And I have it in the book, Remembering the Future, too. You can find it in the book. He said, the first commandment is to love yourself, to have a love for yourself. That doesn't mean, you know, self-centeredness. It means self-awareness, self-care. I care about myself. I love myself in a sense. I want me to be the best me that I can be. And that once you master this, then you have to love your neighbor as yourself. That's why it says the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, this goes into a lot of things. It goes into prayer. It goes into making sure that your neighbor doesn't step in a pit that you see, that he doesn't see. It means not letting your neighbor make a bad investment or to squander what he has. It means not letting your neighbor eat a poison, or to treat themselves poorly or think about themselves poorly, to pray for them. These are great things that it requires to love your neighbor as yourself. And then by doing these things, you are loving God with all your heart and soul and mind. Now, it's amazing to me that the Master tied the human soul and God all together into one contiguous commandment. Because if you think about it, it is virtually impossible to love God and not love your neighbor. It is impossible to love your neighbor when you don't love yourself, right? How can you love somebody else when you hate yourself, or when you're not taking care of yourself, or you don't care for yourself? You can't. All of these things are in line with one with another. It creates this constructive interference. The whole thing that we're talking about here, that's the feeling that comes with this constructive interference. That's why we sing. That's why we dance. That's why we love, because it builds upon us. Yeah. I've heard that before, Eric. Eric says, I have this awful feeling lately that Jesus came because the Father is so cruel and crazy, we had to be saved from him. I get that. I mean, if you look or read the stories of the God of the Old Testament, you see a genocidal maniac, don't you? I mean, most people do. There's a totally different mindset, between the God of the Old Testament, who kills people for holding back a little bit of tithing, poof, dead, just like that, or wiping out a whole community because he wants this tribe to inherit that land. So we kill everybody, including all their animals. In fact, if you spare any of your animals, I'm gonna curse you. I mean, yeah, that's a different kind of God than the commandments Jesus was giving us, right? Maybe it's a little bit different. I know one thing: the God of the Old Testament and the teachings of Jesus are radically different from one another. And when you're taught by Jesus, when you realize you have a personal relationship with Jesus and you follow that relationship and you learn lessons from it, it's amazing the things and the time that he takes to teach you simple things. For instance, the greatest lesson that I learned from Jesus, it extended into all kinds of other things, but the greatest lesson that I learned is when I saw his behavior after the resurrection, when Mary showed up at the sepulchre to take care of him in the morning at dawn. The stone was rolled away. The body was gone. She was like losing her mind. This is a person she loved with every fiber of her being, and he's gone. She can't take care of his body and bury him properly and dress him properly, right? So it's weighing on her, and she doesn't really know what to do. There's nobody at the garden. Guards are gone. Peter and John haven't even arrived yet. And so she sees a man who she perceives to be the gardener. And the gardener, she perceives, says to her, "Woman, why weepest thou?" And she said, you know, basically, "My master was buried here, and I was going to take care of him, take care of the body, and he's missing, he's gone." And she's, you know, how a Jewish woman might be, especially of that age, and being so in love with the person who was buried there might be. And all of a sudden, Jesus changed the way that he spoke. Now, his appearance obviously was different because she didn't recognize him right away. But he said, "Mary," in a special way, only that he very tenderly would say to her. He wouldn't say it that way to John, or he wouldn't say it that way to Matthew or to Peter, but he did say it to her when he was alone with her, when he was walking with her, when she was, you know, putting oil in his hair, washing his feet. Yes, then he would say it this way to her, only that way to her. And that's when she recognized his voice. She recognized his soul, his spirit, even though his body may have looked a little bit different. And that's when she went to reach for him. And he said, "Touch me not." Can you imagine that? Like, the first thing you would want to do is just embrace this woman, right? And feel that love. "Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended unto my Father, which is in heaven. You go tell the others that I have arrived." Now, it's easy to glaze over that. But when you go there, when you're standing there sort of out of phase, and he's teaching you this lesson, you realize the priorities that he had. He was a resurrected being at that point, the first resurrected being. The first thing that you should do is complete the mission, go back to the Father, and finish the mission. Right? But he didn't do that. Before he went to visit, to return to his own Father, he returned to her. That's the amount of love he had for Mary. Now, that's an incredible lesson. He risked everything. He risked perhaps corrupting, contaminating the entire mission just to see her, just to show her and speak to her and tell her, "I have returned. You can't touch me, but I just wanted to let you know I love you." Wow, that's a great lesson, isn't it? That's what I think Eric is talking about, that maybe Jesus is a different person. And he was. I don't think that Jesus is God in the flesh. Well, yes, God in the flesh in the sense that Jesus is God, but not in the sense that Jesus is the God of the Old Testament. Two completely different beings. Just makes a lot of sense. It makes sense to me, and when things make sense to me, they're usually right. Yeah, the greatest passion. Exactly, Susie. Exactly. Now, this resonance is what we're trying to transfer one to another. So it means that we have to have patience with one another, and we have to have a care for one another that goes to this level, whether we're talking to each other on the radio or whether we're meeting one another on the street. Here's the thing. Even people you really never really get to know, like the guy down at the Minute Mart that makes the coffee in the morning. Before I go to work, I always stop and get a coffee. I don't even know his name. But I guarantee you, nobody that comes in that place treats him the way that I do, communicates with him the way that I do, remembers things that he tells me the way that I do. Why? Because I want to look for the good in people like that. And I want to help it to grow a little bit every day. I don't have to do it all at once. In fact, if you do it all at once, it's kind of weird. But if you do it just a little bit over time, they will change. And right now he's on volume 2 of the Birth Trilogy. He already read volume 1. I just gave it to him. And he read it. And guess what he did? He gave it back. And then I re-gifted it to the next person. And now he's on volume 2. And so I could tell that he's reading because he's changing. And the interesting thing is, I don't think anybody ever gave this guy anything, ever. In fact, I think people have taken from him a lot in his life. The fact that somebody would give him something that they wrote, that they care about, that they think is important, that means a lot to him. And it's changing him. Day by day, it's how you save the planet. So, yeah, there are a lot of unanswered questions here, such as, well, there are quantitative things like degree and the extent of synchronous engagements between electromagnetic fields of different brains. And I don't know if we'll ever get to where we can measure that. But we know that it exists because we know what the influence of drugs and anesthetics and we know the effect these things have on the semi-field because we can measure it with an electroencephalogram. And yet the semi-theory provides a new paradigm in which consciousness is rooted in an entirely physical, measurable, and artificially malleable physical structure. And for physicists like me, that's important because it's reliable, it's repeatable, it's something measurable. It means it really exists. The semi-field theory thereby delivers a kind of dualism, particles and waves. Humans, yeah, we're a bag of carbon and protein and water, but we also have a wave presence about us. There is a difference in a live human and a dead human, and not just the 21 grams of the soul. I mean the energy level of that soul, the presence of that soul. You can get on an elevator with someone with that presence. You don't have to speak to them. You don't even have to know them, but you will feel that presence. It is a scientific dualism. It's built on the distinction between matter and energy, whether that matter is spirit or whether it's consciousness, that remains to be seen. But consciousness is what algorithms that exist simultaneously in the space of the brain's electromagnetic field feel like. And they are not static. They are dynamic, which means we can change them. What does that mean, Hitchhiker? Feels Christ is close and interacting with so many. Yes, and I think on an individual basis. And when people say, oh, you need to have a relationship with Jesus, it sounds hollow, doesn't it? It sounds like a bumper sticker, like something that it's easy to say, but you don't even understand what you're saying, do you? You don't really mean that. But when you go into meditation and just realize that, yeah, the Savior of the world can actually slow time down so that you can individually spend an afternoon with him and let him teach you something like the true love of a woman, how important it is to have a soulmate. And in fact, I think one of the things that humbles me to the dust is, even though it was Jesus, even though he was who he was, and he knew who he was, and knew what the mission was, and he had a choice to do it or not do it, he didn't do it alone. He had his Mary. He had his Mary, and she was with him all the way to the end. Very powerful stuff. All right, let's talk a little bit about the election, because we only have a few days left. And Sunday night is going to be, you know, 3 hours of who knows what, because there's a lot of evidence that's coming out tonight. Yes, tonight. It's probably coming out right now as we speak, or maybe has already come out. And once that information is out in the public domain, it's going to change Joe Biden's eligibility to run for president. Nothing may officially happen, but there are going to be people who are desirous to change their vote because of it. So there are two recent reports, and when you combine these two recent reports, including the one that's coming out tonight, they paint a very dark pathway for America in the coming weeks. And I don't want to follow that path. I want us, starting here tonight, the few hundred or so that are listening live right now, and the few thousand that will listen to this archive over the next few days, us few thousand, I want to shine a light on a different path. Okay? The 79 Days report by the Claremont Institute and the Texas Policy Foundation illuminates possible election legal battles on the horizon and how they might play out in the courts. Some of those are already playing out. For instance, the court battle over whether Pennsylvania can receive ballots with or without signatures for some days or weeks after Election Day. That has already been shot down in the courts. There are armies of attorneys that are filing and chasing legal steps to make sure that certain things don't happen or do happen in this election process. But that doesn't mean that the dark side is going to surrender. The global syndicate does not like to surrender. They don't lose that way. As you know, war only ends. It only ends when one side surrenders. And they're not going to surrender, which means the war continues. Yes, we'll have battles. We'll win and we'll lose, but the war will continue. So on election night, I want you to be ready for the fact that the winner may not be known due to millions of uncounted mail-in ballots in these six battleground states. Given there's no clear victor, these very intense court fights are going to start ramping their way through the federal courts and at a very high level with a lot of money behind them. And these are going to be expected to fight their way all the way to January 6th. To the joint session of Congress. Uncertainty could extend even beyond this as decisions for both the presidency and vice presidency are battled out in Congress and before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, there are a couple things people are not taking into consideration when they're talking about the 20th Amendment and even the ramifications that come because of it. Basically, they're trying to decide who's going to be president, who's going to be vice president. Typically, if you go by the 20th Amendment, it's Congress that decides who's president and the Senate who decides who's going to be vice president. But what they're overlooking, and they seem to be overlooking in the press right now, but the lawyers are all in the blocks and ready to go, is that it is not this Congress that makes that decision. No. It's the new Congress. Because the founding fathers realized that if there is an election, it's because the people are choosing a new Congress and a new Senate. Now, yes, a lot of those will be reelected. But remember, there are 12 Republican senators that are up for reelection, and everybody in the Congress is up for reelection because they're elected every 2 years. Think about it, though, for a second. We're only 12 seats apart in the Congress. 12 seats separate who gets to run the committees between the two major parties, Democrat and Republican. So if you have 435 congressmen that are up for election, and the people, November 3rd, choose to, let's say, drop or to change, let's just say 30 seats to round things off. 30 Democrats are tossed out of office and they are replaced with 30 Republicans. Well, not only would that be historic, it wouldn't be as bad a shellacking as happened in 2014, but it would be a hell of a shellacking. Wouldn't be as bad as the one that happened in 1994 with the Newt Gingrich, but it would be a hell of a shellacking. The point is that on January 6th, you have a new Congress. And that new Congress is going to have a new speaker, right? And if 30 Republicans replace 30 Democrats, the Democrats are not going to control the committees. There won't be a Democrat-controlled House judiciary. There won't be a Democrat Speaker of the House. It will be a Republican. Republicans will control all the committees. There'll be a Republican Speaker of the House. It is this new Congress, this 2021 Congress, that will choose the President of the United States. And keep in mind, it's not going to be 435 congressmen that choose the President of the United States. They're not going to sit down as that body and do that. In other words, let's suppose these six states, these battleground states we're talking about, let's just say that they don't certify their vote. Let's just say six states decide, I'm sorry, we're not ready. Secretary of State's Democrats say, we're not going to certify the vote we're not going to turn in a vote. Well, that's fine. That's fine. Because 44 states will have certified. And those 44 states will have congressmen and senators that are elected and are certified. And those 44 states worth of those individuals do form a quorum easily. Now, when you consider the 20th Amendment, remember that it is not a population vote for the president. Nope. It is one vote per state. One vote per state. So there'll be 44 states. Let's say these six states don't certify, so they don't have individuals in Congress yet because they haven't yet decided who's going to be in the Congress because they can't certify their vote. But there are 44. So those 44 states will each contribute one vote. And yes, it could be tied 22-22, but I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it because right now Republicans control 26 states, Democrats control 22 states, and I think it's going to be way more lopsided toward the Republicans because of the way the Democrats have behaved in the last 3 years. It's just, especially the last 2 years, having sold the people on the idea that they were going to go fight for health care, and all they did was fight for impeachment. They didn't fight 1 second, not 1 millisecond for health care. They only fought for impeachment, and they lost. So there'll be 44 votes cast for the new president, and chances are that they're going to select President Trump. So I look for continuity there. That's the legal side. The street side could be something quite a bit different. So I'm not exactly sure how that's going to go, because you got New York, you got LA, you got Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, Portland, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and they're all managed by Democrat mayors. And not all those mayors are going to be changed out. In fact, some of them aren't up for election. So they've had months to prepare, and now they're ready to do battle. These protests, the riots, the looting, violent attacks in the last 6 months, they're just a warm-up act. They're just a warm-up act. There's an unbelievable amount of money and an unbelievable amount of rage in the form of this possession that I was talking about that is spread among these 22 states. I don't know how many cities, like 120 cities. The kickoff is likely to be the U.S. Senate vote to confirm Amy Coney Barrett. Now, it did. It made people very angry. But I don't see a lot of momentum from that. I saw, you know, a shooting over a guy that was wielding a knife when they probably could have just tased the guy or, you know, somehow tackled him or roped him in. They could have easily overpowered a guy with a knife, but they decided to shoot him, and that was certainly a catalyst. But once these demonstrations begin, there is the hope on the dark side that they're not going to end anytime soon. It'll be like a bomb, okay? Every effort to try to stop them is just going to make it worse. And, you know, that's unless Joe Biden wins by some kind of blowout, but that's not going to happen. If anything, it's going to be close. And more than likely what it's going to be is Joe Biden wins the popular vote because of California, and President Trump wins the electoral vote, and I'm saying 330 electors. But if these six states hold out, then it's going to be somewhat less than that. If it does go to where he doesn't have 270 electors, then it's going to go to Congress, the new Congress, not the old one. And it's going to be one vote per state, and it's still going to end up being President Trump. So given that this 79 days report that was done by this think tank is accurate, that many ballots will not be tabulated until days and months after the voting concludes, the protesters are going to flood into the streets, and they're going to demand that all the ballots be counted no matter when they were filed, even the rental trucks that are backing up, you know, 2 months after the election. Same as Stacey Abrams did, where she said there was massive voter suppression because they were still trying to count votes, you know, a month after the election. And of course, the lawyers are going to be filing suits, you know, right and left to try to force things to go their way. If you go back to the year 2000, the election was put on hold when George Bush won Florida by a narrow margin. And by narrow, I mean narrow. And it was triggered. It triggered an automatic recount, and then another, and then another. And 6 weeks afterwards, we still didn't know. And finally, the Supreme Court had to step in and end the squabbling. You've had all these different recounts. George Bush is still president of the United States, and that's it. It's over. And I think that's what will happen now, but or happen in this case as well. And of course, they're going to yell foul because President Trump appointed three of those justices, and they expect that they will all vote his way. Now, the Hold the Line report lays bare the leftists' ground game. It's going to take a lot of money because these people are not going to riot without money. You know why? Because it's a totally different game. After the election, it's a totally different game. Now we're talking about much more severe penalties, maybe Gitmo, maybe 10 years in prison. If people die, then you have group culpability, which can go to the federal level, you know, sort of like driving the getaway car for a bank robbery and somebody is killed in the robbery. Yeah, you were just driving the car, but you're an accessory to murder after the fact. Activists are locked and loaded But without money, without the follow through, it isn't going to happen. If we, that is to say, those of you that are within the sound of my voice tonight or the next few days, if we decide to have a much higher frequency, if we decide to not fight but to love, we can diffuse all of this information. That rage will go away because it won't find any positive constructive interference through us. It'll be negatively interfered with a much higher frequency that will soothe the soul rather than excite the soul. Let's see, what is that, Eric? Catholics like me believe Mary is, oh, Queen of Heaven. I see. Sorry, it was a typo, Eric. Queen of Heaven, which makes one wonder if she always was. Yes, it does make one wonder. It makes us wonder what we were, too, before we came here. I think some of us, maybe even some of this chat room tonight, did not have to come back and do a mortal life. We had already overcome everything. There was no reason to come back. But I can tell you that death is much easier than I thought it would be. I mean, really, I expected it to be difficult. I expected it to be painful, and it wasn't. It was so easy. In fact, when the police revived me after my motorcycle wreck, the very first thing I told the cop as he was pulling the earbuds out of my ears and taking the helmet off my head was, that was easy. It was the easiest thing in the world, dying. You don't feel anything. And I realized it really doesn't matter how you die, whether you're hit by a car, burned alive, or die slowly with a debilitating, painful disease. Once you're dead, none of that matters. None of that is remembered. There is something, though, and that thing is regret. Not regret for anything that you left undone, because that doesn't matter either, believe it or not, but for the people that you left behind. It was sort of like leaving for work in the morning and forgetting to kiss the people you love before you leave. You leave for work and then you just walk away. There's this level of regret that you, it's difficult to explain, difficult to explain. So when you see mankind come down here and go into another mortal life to try to ratchet up their learning, their experience to the next level, to write something else in the Akashic record, the only thing that you have is regret that you're not there with them, that you have this little extra bit of experience, this maybe one more round of memory, one more round of experience or mastery, where you can help them by either lifting them up or pushing them up or carrying them up to the next level. And there is that. So when you think about Mary being the Queen of Heaven, and was she always, it's a good question, and we should ask ourselves that. What were we before we came here? Now that you're given this information, you're now liable for it, right? You're going to be held accountable for knowing that you are an eternal being having a mortal experience. The level of being able to transfer a thought from somewhere east of the Appalachian Mountains to anywhere in the world live, and having that thought received and understood, changes the lives of those people that hear those ideas, especially if they're young enough, they can incorporate them and do something about it tomorrow or the next day. So Mary's presence here was so powerful that standing at the base of the crucifixion, the first thing that Jesus did from the cross is he said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In other words, forgive the guards. They're just following orders. They don't really know what they're doing. They've done this so many times before. They don't know who I am or anything. But then one of the things that he did was so powerful, because standing down at his feet were his mother, but also his great friend and disciple, John. And so he looked at Mary and said, "Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother." In other words, take care of my mom. Very powerful charge that was given to John the Beloved, and also to Mary, his mother, because a widow who has lost a son is a special charge in Jewish society. And when you can make the assignment on your deathbed to assign her care to someone who you want to take care of your mother, it's an important thing to do, a very powerful custom. So Mary was a powerful person. And when you think about the 14 generations of the house of David that she carried the crown with her genetics. She passed that earth crown of David on to Jesus, which truly did make him the heir of the crown of David. Yeah, so saying that he was king of the Jews may not have been that far off. A lot of things came through that lineage, and lineage is important. Hitchhiker says, we must energetically stop as much of the violence as we can. Yeah, I don't mean stand in the way of it out there with your car or your truck with your Trump flags on it. But there is a way of making sure that our desire for peace is extended out there. In other words, these people want to shut down society until President Trump is forced from office. That's what they've stated. I already feel that that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. They want to do a similar thing like the 28 days of resistance in Tunisia that toppled President El Abidine Ben Ali, and the 25th January revolution in Egypt that ousted President Hosni Mubarak. I was there. I left just a day or so before that happened. And such an event is really not possible in the United States. We're too big. We're too well informed. We have too much love, and we're not a banana republic in that way. But if Trump is reelected, and I believe that he will be, and he will be by a substantial margin, maybe even he will win the popular vote. But that's not really going to be the disruptive part. The disruptive part is going to be the 5 or 6 states that refuse to certify their vote. That's never happened before. We've had faithless electors before, and they're dealt with very swiftly in state and even in the federal constitution. But we've never had faithless states before. We've had states secede from the Union, and that was recovered through a million American lives. But I don't think that's what's going to happen here. We're not talking about the will of a state. We're talking about the will of a secretary of state, right? We're talking about the will of a governor. For instance, here in North Carolina, we are a Republican state. We have a Republican Congress. We have a Republican state Senate. But we have a Democrat crook for a governor. Does he have an effect? Yeah. Can he get anything passed? No, not really. We have a supermajority. But he can do things like lock the state down and put, you know, wear mask mandates in place and shut business down, which he has done. He cost the state over $200 million just in the election alone. All of this is very powerful and has its effect, but I don't think we're going to end up in civil war. I think that these 5 or 6 states can be talked into coming back simply by changing secretaries of state. So the important thing is to go out, look for the good in one another, help it to grow a little bit every day. Do it on a local level. It has a ripple effect. You don't have to go to your state house. You don't have to even go to your city capital. All you really have to do is do it to the people that are next to you, that are close to you, that you meet with every single day, no matter how insignificant. In fact, the more insignificant they are, the better it is, because that kind of stuff spreads. And if we have that effect from this program forward, It's now Wednesday night. We're talking about next Tuesday, about this time, 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Things should be pretty well in hand. We may not know for a couple of days who is actually president, because if you remember, in 2016, they didn't want to report. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't want to report because they were so shocked at the outcome. Same thing may happen here. Same thing may happen here. But eventually, we're going to know, and eventually, peace will prevail, and we will be one again. So this is X Squared Radio on America Free Radio Network, coming to you live through Revolution Radio, saying where we go one, we go all. Peace, Earth Explorers. Now go and do great things. Settle for nothing less. Seek the best things in life. Share them with one another, and you will change the world. All great world changes start with just one or two people. Why not you? Why not now? I feel the same way. Do I think the tales of private mercenary type imported groups? Yes, I do. I think there are groups of mercenaries inside this country. They have been paid money to disrupt this country, and they're going to be about their business, but they can be contained. We are a big nation with a big heart, and we're not going to kick anybody out. We're going to accommodate everyone. And hopefully we will not let this expand. They'll have their little conflict in the middle of the street, and nobody will pay any attention to it, least of all us. So we'll see you Sunday night here at 8 o'clock. Same bat time, same bat channel, but a different day. And we'll prepare ourselves for the election on Tuesday night. Bring a friend, and don't forget to get over to dlive.tv/Brooks Agnew. The link is right down here in the bottom. And follow me, because once we get to 200 followers, we can then play archives in that blockchain platform. And it can make a difference. It can make it. Thank you for the contributions tonight. Thanks for being in the chat room. Susie, Delina, nice to see you out there.
Listen to Revolution.